Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Well, this is Steve Nurse again, and this is our program, our second series on Vietnam. And again, what we're trying to do is not look so much at the political, but look at the personal aspects of it. And today we're interviewing Don Rudolph. Don contacted me. He used to live on Vae Shan. Now he lives in Henderson, Nevada. By Vegas, and he's a professional gambler now. No, it's not true. Don was a Vietnam veteran, much like many of the veterans that came from that era. Maybe one out every four was certainly drafted and came from all parts of the country and all nationalities, all races, all colors. It was a pretty eclectic group. So, Don, tell me about how you got involved in the war in Vietnam.
I graduated in 1965 in high school. I grew up in the Bay Area just north of San Francisco. I went to college right after high school, got a college deferment. So the war really wasn't on my mind that much. I knew it was going on, but I felt like it was for somebody else, somebody that wanted to be there. I had no real interest in it, and I just went about my business. And, of course, about that time, the Cultural Revolution was taking place, with San Francisco being kind of the epicenter of the whole movement, with the music and the hippies and all that. And I was kind of involved in that. And so I just went about my way. And eventually, one day, it was Thanksgiving, and I was at my aunt's house, and she had gotten a letter for me from the Selective Service telling me I was to report within 5 days of Thanksgiving. So on December 3rd, 1969 was the day that I enlisted.
Okay, and we had talked about that. Yeah, that you had been over at your aunt's house for Thanksgiving, and had a nice turkey dinner, and then got your
It kind of spoiled my appetite.
Yeah, here's one more thing. you now get to serve in the U.S. government army for another couple of years.
Right.
Yeah, and at that time, you're right. San Francisco was kind of the. I saw where they just turned Hyde Park into a kids' park down in the middle of San Francisco, and let's see, if you lived north of San Francisco, you probably lived in like Mill Valley or.
No, I lived in Petaluma.
Okay,
it was a rural area. It's about 40 miles north in Sonoma County.
Right.
Back in those days, it was maybe around 25,000 population. It's known as the egg capital of the world. There were lots of chicken ranches in that.
Oh, okay.
And if you've ever seen the movie American Graffiti,
yes,
it was actually filmed there and in Santa Rosa, which is another.
Oh, is that right?
It was actually, if you took a snapshot of my life, that would have been a part of it. It was just exactly like that. Mm-hmm. Drive up and down the streets on the weekends, and that was life in the 60s.
Well, you do have more hair now than Ron Howard or Opie. So,
yeah, I've done better than him, but not as good as others.
So, So, the question we've always asked everybody here is, what was What was your first impression of Vietnam when you landed? You said you came in on a Braniff airline.
Yeah, Braniff was is now a defunct airline, but back in the days, they must have negotiated a contract with the federal government. So everybody flew over in a nice air-conditioned commercial airplane and landed in Vietnam, and then the doors would open, and you get hit like you're walking into an oven. It was very hot and humid and pretty shocking, after, especially after a long air-conditioned ride.
And didn't you say, too, that as you were landing, you saw flashes? And
I did, yeah. And I remember asking the stewardess, is that lightning? Or says, well, you know, don't know what it is, but, you know, keep your head down.
And yeah, and that's, you know, one of the friends, he said that had happened, too, that they were dropping probably mortar rounds, weren't mm-hmm. they? Yeah,
right.
That they're dropping. And yeah. You were after Tet then, or
I was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got over there right at the beginning of May 1970, and it just so happened that Nixon had authorized us to go into Cambodia for 2 months, because leading up to that, the Vietnamese used what they called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they brought people and munitions and food down through Laos, Cambodia, and then they would cut through what's called the fishhook area of Vietnam and lodge their attacks from there. And there were, I guess, at least 60 to 70,000 Vietnamese, North Vietnamese regulars that stayed over there. Very large bunker complexes, hospitals, you name it, was all there.
I think it's a Cu Chi where they have a lot of the tunnels, too, where they, you know, literally had hospitals and mm-hmm. everything underground.
Yeah, they had some. One of the complexes that was found in Canberra, they call it the city. You know, it had swimming pools, hospitals, the whole works. You know, it was
wow.
just a huge place.
Wow.
So I started my combat duty in the jungles of Cambodia, actually.
Okay, and so you went to Cambodia, and what was your average day like? What did you do? Did you, you know?
We would go out for about 3 weeks at a time on reconnaissance patrols, and so we carried enough food, ammunition, and supplies to last us at least a week between getting resupplied via a Huey that would come through if the weather permitted. So the packs we carried were 60 to 80 pounds heavy, and a typical day would be humping about 5 kilometers a day through the jungle and looking for the enemy. And it was kind of like hunting and being hunted all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And what were you looking for? Were you looking for like a smoke or a...
No, I think it was basically intelligence had come up with film or something. I don't know what they used in that time to
indicate. They used
indicate
like a spotter plane or something?
Yeah, they used spotter planes. And, you know, there were... Actually, I worked in an area where they had G2 intelligence, and I found out they actually had little microphones in some of the trees in the jungle. So if they heard, you know, sounds, they would direct the artillery or the troops to go and seek it out, you know, find out. So
yeah.
We would be taken by chopper and dropped off in these areas that they suspected enemy activity in.
And so you said that you were the medic and you were assigned. Were there five? How many other people were assigned with you when you'd gone one of the?
I was a medic for a platoon of about 25 guys.
Okay, so a platoon is 25.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Approximately.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we would go out and be hunted. If we didn't find anything, the choppers would pick us up and take us to another zone that they expected activity.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, just, you know, one of the hardest parts, I think, was dealing with the elements for me. There were, you know, snakes, poisonous snakes, leeches, rats, you name it.
Did you have to deal with snake bites, you yourself?
I never got bit, but I saw several bamboo vipers, which are pretty pretty lethal. And a lot of spiders, leeches, mosquitoes, of course. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, monkeys in trees. I mean, you name it, they were out there.
Yeah. Interesting. I saw a lot of the vets that had pictures of monkeys. You know, and mm-hmm. you know, I remember one telling us that they had been shooting into the bush, you know, and thought they were shooting at people, and the next morning they get up and they found out it's one dead monkey, you know, and
I can see that happening.
Yeah. And so what did you carry in your rucksack? Medical supplies?
I had an ammo can that had medical supplies, mostly field dressings, morphine, ointments, and
so something to keep them alive. I mean, you know, patch.
Yeah, it was my job was mostly keep them alive. It was like emergency medical technician. So, somebody got wounded. You know, we want to keep them alive long enough for a medevac to pick them up and get them to a hospital.
How long did that take? I mean, were you?
It really depends on the circumstances. The weather sometimes could affect that. If it's a real hot zone and there's a lot of firing, shooting going on, then they tend not to want to come in right at that point. So, it could be delayed. But generally, I would say, you know, half an hour, maybe.
From what I hear, most of the pilots that flew the Hueys were pretty courageous.
They were. They were very brave,
getting people out.
Bad circumstances, usually.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for them.
Yeah. And so... You say you resupplied about every, 3 to 5 days or something?
Well, for us, it was about once a week. So to answer your question, so we carried, obviously, a lot of water and sea rations. And the sea rations were all in cans. They were heavy. So a typical pack weighed about 60 to 80 pounds when we first started off. And, of course, you get a little lighter as you empty the cans and drink the water. But it was pretty heavy. And then I carried an M16 and couple of bandoliers of ammo and a handgun. And
did you take like salt tablets all the time?
Yeah, the salt, for sweating and that. It was pretty hot and humid, so salt tablets were part of our regime, and malaria tablets, iodine in the water to kind of help purify it a little bit, and that was all part of the day.
I worked up on top of Snoqualmie Pass and a landing for Boise Cascade and working around, you know, right out in all that asphalt and right out in the sun. And anytime we drank water, we were required to take salt tablets because dehydrate yourself and get your electrolytes messed up.
So we'd go out, pretty much walk, through the jungles, machetes and all that. And sometimes, the enemy would, be there and we'd have a little firefight. I was lucky. Most of our firefights were pretty quick. They do their thing and then go back in the jungle. And I was lucky. Most of the time, we didn't take any real serious casualties. And then we'd camp at night. And for some reason, we always seemed to camp in what's considered triple canopy jungle, which is very dark and hard to...
And you said it was just... pretty difficult to see anything.
I'd never seen darkness like that before. I mean, literally, I remember putting my hand in front just to see if I could see my hand. You literally can't see your hand in front of your face an inch away, so it's very dark. We would set up booby traps, trip wires and things if we were near a trail. And
would the tripwire set off? It wouldn't set off the claymore.
No, I think they, the infantry guys did it, but I think they were using hand grenades on that. But then we'd always, every night, have claymore mines set up with a clacker device, it's called, that somebody would manually. So if somebody hit the tripwire and the hand grenades exploded, then somebody would manually push the claymores, and then invariably there would be incoming, outgoing small arms fire until... things settled down a little bit.
And were the Viet Cong, were they pretty well supplied? Did they have good equipment? Did they have...
Not state-of-the-art. I'm sure ours was, probably superior. But the AK-47 was a weapon that was pretty dependable for them.
Was that Chinese a weapon?
Yeah, I believe it is. Yeah. So mostly, that's mostly what I saw was, small arms fire.
But basically, you said that most of your time was just kind of maintaining troops.
Yeah, as a medic. As a medic, I spent a lot of time doing that.
Is jungle rot like similar to athlete's foot, kind of?
Kind of, yeah, yeah. It's yeah, the skin just starts peeling off, and a lot of ringworm, a lot of bites from mosquitoes and leeches and anything else out there. And in the jungle, stuff can be infected pretty quickly if it's not treated. So I treated the troops morning, noon, and night pretty much every day.
I remember when we were in Costa Rica, my wife cut her foot maybe 3/4 of an inch, and she didn't think anything of it, and they said, no, because of the humidity, you need to get in and see a doctor and get it cleaned out, because in that type of environment, it can become infected and really difficult.
And it doesn't take long,
And once you get that sepsis in your system, it's pretty tough to get it out.
Right. I didn't really realize at the time. I was young, and I guess I thought I was just there to take care of gunshot wounds, basically. But really, looking back on it, my job was to keep these guys in the field, more than that even. It was to keep them with the ability to walk and keep our platoon intact.
Tell me your leech story. We heard this.
Yeah, that was a memorable day. I don't know why. I don't remember many days over there, but this one just happened to be July 4th, 1970. And somebody had determined that the enemy was near a river. And so we were sent to go track them down. And as we approached the river, all of a sudden, we see the ground. It's like moving. And it was really pretty odd. It was dark and black soil, it looked like. And finally, we get to it, and it turns out it was probably literally millions of leeches. And so they're crawling up our feet and then falling out of the trees from above on us. And we spent the whole day in that leech field. And I remember it pretty well because it was not a pleasant experience.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question coming from an intelligent interviewer, but what do leeches, well, I mean, you would think of there's a food chain, right? If there's that many millions of leeches.
Yeah, I don't know what they lived on,
But during that time, they lived on you.
Well, they like smelling blood. I know that. That's what they were after. And of course, being in the military, rumors are rampant. So one of the first things we hear about is somebody getting 2 leeches that crawl up his penis. It had to be surgically removed. Oh. So we're all like totally paranoid about that, making sure everything's strapped down tight. Nobody wanted that,
Yeah, that is true. You start hearing those stories and they kind of get, he had 2. Well, this guy had 6.
I didn't want any.
They made a home in there.
Not good.
Yeah, yeah. What did they, did you see many of the locals? Were you around locals or?
No.
It sounds like you were kind of out in the.
I was out in the sticks for most of my tour, for a good part of it anyway. I've heard the stories of, going in and destroying villages. And I never saw any villages. I never, I was called baby killer at one point when I came home, and I never saw one baby, I can tell you that. I probably saw probably less than a dozen South Vietnamese. I probably saw more North Vietnamese than I did South Vietnamese.
Is that right? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. We had interviewed Phil Maharan, and he was in a band, and they went into the kind of make friends with the natives, so to speak, and played music for them and inoculated the kids and did all that stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys. I know. Guy was Marine that went into the villages and helped with take care of the families here and stuff like that.
Yeah, so yeah.
Just depend on the role, I was just happened to be in a different situation.
Yeah. What, when you got back to the United States, what was the reaction of people? I mean, you were explaining
that. Well, I just kind of mentioned, I got on a public bus. I was heading to my sister and, my 2 nieces, Joan, Kathy, and Karen, at an apartment about 40 miles from Oakland, where I landed, and Travis Air Force Base. And so I got on a bus, and people around me, everybody got up and moved to the rear. And I didn't know what the deal was until somebody called me a baby killer. And I was like, well, I'm just happy to be alive. It was just a little shocking. I wasn't really, I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting that.
And, yeah, yeah.
It didn't, I know some people were really, bothered by the reception, but I can't say it really bothered me. I was more happy just to be alive and in one piece than to worry about what somebody said. So I just,
Do you think you had PTSD when you got back?
I probably did. Yeah, I probably did. They say it doesn't go away, but I know the first few years, I had a lot of nightmares and, I went to college using a GI Bill after I got out of the Army. And,
so you're pretty busy right after you got
out. I kept myself really busy, so I didn't dwell on it. I think that helped. I think that helped me. I was able to just kind of put a distance between it and
you got married pretty quickly.
I got married about a year after I got back. And actually, I had to serve some time back at Fort Lewis after I got back from Vietnam. So my wife and I met, and we got married pretty quickly once I decided I was ready to settle down. Yeah. And I guess she was, too.
And she was from the Seattle area or the...
No, this was in California.
Oh, okay.
We both were from Northern California.
Okay, yeah.
And then we moved up here years later.
What did you learn from Vietnam?
Well, I guess for me personally, it was more of a... getting my life together, making my life meaningful. I had determined early on when I was getting shot at one time that if I lived through this thing, I was going to try to do something with my life. So that was why when I did get back, I went to college and tried to live my life as for the people that didn't make it back, in a sense, too. I know it's kind of hokey, but a lot of guys that probably had dreams and ambitions that families weren't able to fulfill them. And so I always kind of in the back of my mind thinking, well, gee, I want to be a good person, for those that didn't, that gave their lives.
And you mentioned that you'd been to a kind of a replica of the wall, but you've never been to the wall.
Right, correct, yeah.
Yeah. I've taken students back there on tours. And there's always a lot of controversy on how it was built.
But I've seen pictures of it. It looks very moving.
And I think it's very kind of ominous. It's stark.
Mm-hmm.
And also things that people left on the wall.
Right.
Everything from Jack Daniels to cigarettes to Purple Hearts. Yeah. And you mentioned your family is doing well now.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. I have two sons. They've both been very successful. And my wife and I are enjoying our retirement years in Henderson, Nevada, and using a swimming pool when it's hot. And, I can't complain. Life has been good to me. I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, that's great. And are there things that you... Is it a situation where Vietnam might have been, was it a winnable war?
Well, I think if they had let us, take the bindings off and just let us go and be fighting soldiers without restrictions, I think, politics probably did play a role in this. As far as like in Cambodia, we were told we couldn't go past 10 miles. And so, the Vietnamese just went past that 10 miles so we wouldn't chase after them any further. So I think there were a lot of restrictions. I think it could have been one if we had been given the ability to do that. I think put the brakes on.
A lot of people have said that if it was fought by the politicians, it might have gone over a lot earlier and had a positive result.
Yeah, it's war is an ugly business. I can say that for a fact.
And, are you glad you went?
I am. Yeah, I think it was life changing for me. I had no direction. Both my folks had passed away. relatively young, and I was kind of a lost soul, I have to admit, during that time. And going in the military and then Vietnam in particular kind of helped me get focused on what's important, and I think it actually helped me.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say that a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. I never would have guessed it at the time, believe me. At the time, I was not... Yeah, I wasn't gung-ho to go over there, and, you know, I never thought I would say what I just said of, oh, gee, I'm glad I went.
And when we talk to folks like Robert, who were kind of gung-ho, you were kind of the opposite.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was a draftee. You didn't have any choice. I did not volunteer.
Yeah.
But I understood. I really thought it was much higher. I just read the other day it was only 25% of us were draftees. I thought it would have been more the other way around.
I would have thought so, too. Yeah. And they did empty those parts of the town that poor people lived in.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I say, I think most of us felt like we were the disposable part of society, that our lives weren't as valuable as the wealthy. You didn't see a lot of wealthy, you know, people from wealthy families over there. At least that was my experience. And then coming back and, you know, being called names and things, I think, you know, it's kind of a weird deal with our society. You send the lowest echelon over to fight your fights for the wealthy, in a sense, you know, and then in our case, there wasn't much appreciation either.
But, yes,
yes. But it was.
Well, that's about all I have to say. Uh-huh. And I think that any final statements?
No, I think we touched on it. I can say that I've personally received excellent care from the Veterans Administration. I know there's a lot of stories out there, but they've taken good care of my health needs, and GI Bill got me through college, so no regrets. You know, it all worked out okay for me.
Well, thanks.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Glad to help you and get your message across.
Thank you.
Well, you take care and have a good day, and we will see you, Vashon. And enjoy the rest of the beautiful day.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.